headlines this hour. Iran's leader says the economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions, reiterating that the country's policies have already proven progress can be made despite sanctions. The Yemeni army releases details of its latest retaliatory operations against the Saudi-led coalition countries. And day 26 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Kyiv announces a deal on 8 humanitarian corridors from besieged areas that excludes the port city of Mariupol. Hello, welcome to This Is News. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, once again stresses that the country's economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said while the sanctions removal should be sought, the country must be run in a way that restrictions cannot harm its economy. The leader said that national production is an important factor also. Plus, he added domestic economy should be knowledge-based. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the Iranian nation on the occasion of the Persian New Year. The leader also touched upon the Ukraine conflict and how it revealed what he called the blatant racism rampant in the West. He criticized Western countries for their double standards in dealing with white and black refugees. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the West for blackmailing independent countries by exploiting the concept of human rights. The Yemeni army has released details of its retaliatory attacks, including the latest operations dubbed Breaking the Siege. Now, these attacks have hit targets in Saudi Arabia and its allied countries in the ongoing war in Yemen over the past 7 years.
A Yemen hurricane was also launched, and the break of the siege operations were also launched. The total of sum of killed and wounded of the enemy, 275,143 wounded or killed from human casualties, the Saudi 10,759, the Emiratis 1,251, the Sudanese 9,440, and the mercenaries that were also the Yemeni mercenaries and Yemeni traitors, 253,693.
Yahya Sari said the Yemeni people have remained resilient and steadfast in the face of the Saudi war. He said that the Yemenis are capable of defending the sovereignty of their country against any acts of aggression. Sari said that the army will continue its retaliatory operations until the Saudi-led war stops. The war began in March 2015. Saudi Arabia and its allies also imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen. The blockade, coupled with daily airstrikes, have worsened the humanitarian situation in Yemen, where tens of thousands have died as a result.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Dhahran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari' has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis.
Just recently, multiple United Nations agencies sounded the alarm over the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, warning that it is only going to get worse. According to the UN, today more than 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure. This is while famine is expected to increase fivefold by 2023, pushing half of all children under five into malnutrition.
The Saudi war in Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Monday marks day 26 of the Russian military operation in Ukraine. Kyiv says both sides have agreed to create 8 humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from besieged towns and cities. The Ukrainian government says the agreement does not include the southeastern port city of Mariupol. The government also says efforts to reach the volatile city with humanitarian supplies have led nowhere. Ukraine has defied a Russian demand that its forces lay down arms before dawn on Monday in Mariupol. Russia has said those who did so would be allowed to leave the city, but those who stay would be turned over to tribunals run by Russian-backed pro-independence forces. Since the conflict has begun, 925 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. That's according to the UN. It says more than 3 million have fled the country. We've talked to our correspondent Rob Carter in the Polish city of Lublin. He has told us about the refugee crisis there caused by the Ukraine-Russia conflict.
Well, as it was predicted by many, more than 2 million Ukrainians have now entered into Poland. So that's the single biggest number of refugees that one country has taken in so far. And obviously it's put tremendous strain on Poland, but there is a massive effort here to cater for all of these new guests, and that effort is still underway. But as for the situation, obviously the fighting is still ongoing, and the more fighting that occurs and the more the situation in Ukraine escalates, the greater the refugee crisis will inevitably be, as there are still, I believe, somewhere about 6.5 million Ukrainians that are actually displaced inside Ukraine, mostly moving over to the western part of Ukraine, which hasn't been so heavily hit by the military operations. That, of course, if it does expand, then, of course, those refugees might decide, you know what, we actually want to get out of Ukraine completely and flee either towards the west, or more refugees could indeed flee actually into Russia itself from the eastern part as well.
The Kremlin says time is not ripe for the presidents of Russia and Ukraine to meet, as peace talks have not progressed significantly.
For us to speak of a meeting between the two presidents, homework has to be done. Talks have to be held and the results agreed upon. There has been no significant progress so far, so it's too early to speak about two presidents meeting, as they won't be able to fixate anything. There are no agreements yet to fixate.
Peskov also said compared to Ukraine, Russia is showing a greater willingness for fast and meaningful agreement. Earlier, the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky renewed his plea for talks with his Russian counterpart, saying that negotiations are the only way to end the war. In an exclusive interview with CNN, Zelensky warned of a possibility of a third world war if such attempts fail. The Ukrainian president at the same time has called on European leaders to cease all trade with Russia to pressure it to stop the conflict. An oil embargo on Russia over its military campaign in Ukraine tops the agenda of the talks between European Union governments and their allies later this week. A senior EU diplomat says the embargo will be part of a new round of sanctions that the bloc is preparing against Moscow. They will be discussed during the upcoming summits of NATO and the Group of Seven major economies. The U.S. and U.K. have already targeted Russia's oil sector, but EU countries are yet to agree on similar measures amid calls for caution by some, including Germany and Bulgaria. France, which holds the rotating presidency of the EU Council, however, says that there should be no taboos if the situation in Ukraine worsens. Moscow has warned that an oil embargo will hit everyone. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about this week's summits and potential European sanctions against Russia in the energy sector.
There will be a couple of big summits at least this week. Later on in the week, we'll have a NATO summit, but also EU leaders will meet here in Brussels. And what's happening today is you have like a series of meeting. At one point, you will have three sets of ministers from the EU meeting at the same time together. And that would be the EU foreign ministers, EU defense ministers, and EU affairs ministers. And they're basically meeting to lay the groundwork for decisions that will be taken by the 27 heads of government when they meet at the summit on Thursday here. And Josep Borrell, he's the EU's foreign policy chief, and very just within the past hour, he entered the meeting to sort of chair the foreign affairs element to it as well. And he talked about the fact that, you know, he made the claim that Russia is committing massive war crimes, to quote him. And he was speaking specifically in relation to what's happening in Mariupol. So, you know, he said it's going to be a very long day. There's a lot of things on the agenda. But as you mentioned, one of the key items is to prepare for possible new sanctions in the area of energy. And this is very, very significant because, as we know, in the EU, we get 27% of our oil and 40% of our gas from Russia. And it's reciprocally, it's a very important agreement that's been going on for years. I mean, Russia makes huge money from supplying this energy. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, the EU is very dependent. It's a very massive element to keeping the EU's economy afloat, is to have this sort of cheap gas coming in particular. But also, I mean, I think that's why they're talking about oil, because if they put some sort of restrictions on imports of oil into the EU, it would have a less damaging effect on the EU itself. But it opens up the question of how Russia might respond.
Political commentator Matus Piskorski says that an oil embargo by the European Union on Russia will backfire on the bloc.
You can easily notice that all what has happened in Ukraine during the last month has affected first and foremost the countries of Central Europe. Then secondly, it has already affected strong economies like the German economy. And by the way, if you look at Germany's role in the European Union, and it would any kind of new embargo against the Russian import of Russian oil would affect first and foremost the German economy. So one might think that the Germans will lose on that. But actually, if you see at the role of Germany as practically the only industrial country of European Union and the only economic superpower of European Union nowadays, then you would notice that Germany is so heavily interconnected, its economy is so heavily interconnected with Central European countries, with some even Western European countries, that a small crisis in Germany, which could be a result of the new sanctions, will affect definitely the whole European Union.
The tensions between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine escalate in the wake of a recent allegation by the U.S. President Joe Biden against his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. The Russian Foreign Ministry has now summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest what it called Biden's unacceptable accusation. The ministry told the envoy that the U.S. President's claim has pushed bilateral ties to the brink of, quote, rupture. Last week, Biden called Putin a war criminal over Russia's offensive in Ukraine. The Kremlin had earlier denounced Biden's remark as unforgivable, citing civilian deaths caused by U.S. military attacks across the globe. A passenger plane with 132 people on board has crashed in southern China. Boeing 737 aircraft took off from the city of Kunming and was en route to Guangzhou when the incident happened. Airline China Eastern says that there have been fatalities without specifying. There's also no word on the cause of the crash. Media reports say the plane completely disintegrated after hitting the ground, sparking a fire in the area where it went down. The Chinese President Xi Jinping said that he was shocked and called for an investigation into the accident. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. from the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today, not in the mood to watch TV. I'd better turn it off. Just one thing can excite me now: a cup of aromatic Iranian tea. Pleasant. just remembered. I had plans to visit the Golestan Palace today. Oh, I have to rush. Getting prepared for today's tour. Golestan Palace, which dates back to more than 440 years ago, is one of the unique historical complexes of Iran. This palace, which belongs to the Zandian Qajar periods, is located in central Tehran. Golestan Palace was registered in Iran National Heritage List in 1956. It was also registered in the UNESCO Heritage List in 2013. Golestan Palace consists of several different structures, including Shamsul Emare, Salam Hall, Mirror Hall, the Marble Throne, Pond House, Abyaz Palace, Karim Khani Nook, Building of Wind Catchers, as well as Ivory, Diamond and Brilliant Halls. The most important historical period of Golestan Palace was during the Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar era. He sat on his throne in this palace and chose Tehran as his capital in 1795. Nasiruddin Shah Qajar also sat on his throne in this palace and was the first king of Iran who had to travel to Europe. Therefore, Golestan Palace was affected by Western architecture because of this attitude of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. I am now on 15 Khordad Street. On Arya Square, Golestan Palace is located on the northern part of this square. Well, there are a few blocks to the palace, and of course, I enjoy taking a walk in the old texture of the city. I am now in the area of Golestan Palace. It's so beautiful. In front of me, there is a big pool which ends in Golestan Palace with its blue tides shining like a beautiful turquoise. Let's enter the palace. Sure, there are many amazing things waiting there for us. Hall. It's extraordinary, unique, breathtaking. It took more than 7 years to make the decorations of this hall. And I am now in the Iwan of the Marble Throne. This part is the oldest structure of Golestan Palace and dates back to Karim Khan Zand era. The most beautiful part of the Iwan is the Marble Throne, which was built by the order of Fatali Shah Qajar. He ordered Isfahani stone cutters to make a throne out of the yellow marble of Yazd in 1806. The throne has 65 big and small marble parts. Designing this throne, which looks like Prophet Solomon's throne, makes you think that the throne is situated on the shoulder of three demons and six angels. The beauties of Golestan Palace cannot be discussed in this brief radio program, but later in the future, I will come back here to describe other amazing parts of this palace.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Economic divide.
The
crisis between Russia and Ukraine has wreaked havoc in global oil markets. Russia plays a pivotal role in the global energy supply, and destabilization could send shockwaves to the global economy. It is the third biggest producer of oil in the world, behind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. It produces around 7 million barrels of oil per day, which is about 7% of global oil supply. Russian imports account for 8% of total U.K. oil demand. More than 40% of what it produces every day goes to Europe. The U.S. is less reliant, with about 3% of its imported oil coming from Russia. Oil prices have reached their highest levels in years. Experts warn sanctions on Russia's energy products could be catastrophic for the global economy. They say the global economy could be facing one of the largest energy supply shocks ever. There are now warnings that prices of oil per barrel could reach $180 to $200.
Here in the United States, I mean, we've imported 200,000 barrels a day. We imported about 450,000 barrels of product, mostly unfinished distillate, that we run through the refinery to boost yields on the other end of the refinery. It comes out more distillate, more gasoline. We don't really need those 200 barrels. We don't need those 450,000 barrels. So we can definitely exist without that. It's a spit in the bucket. The Eurozone, we're talking percentage points, double digits. So it's a totally different game.
Russia has already warned that prices could reach $300 per barrel if the West decides to shun its oil and gas from the markets. Supply shortages, bottlenecks, and price pressures caused by the coronavirus pandemic have already disrupted the global economy, and there are fears that further price shocks would have catastrophic consequences. The whole notion of sanctioning a country is to make the governing body suffer, and not the ordinary citizens. But that may not be the case when it comes to the U.S. in particular, than the Europeans. Let's see what people had to say about that in our social media section of the program. Well, this person has the right idea, even though the U.K. is too entrenched in this already. The U.K. should stay out of the Russia-Ukraine war, apart from that, to de-escalate and then try to bring the fighting to an end. Do not enact a no-fly zone, do not send weapons, and stop ramping up sanctions against all of Russia. That only hurts ordinary people rather than what he or this person says is the regime there. Next one, what a display of duplicity and hypocrisy of Europe's leaders. How can they expect Russia to supply gas, fuel, while their non-military entities, artists, sportspersons, ordinary people are being hit by sanctions? How will Germany or Hungary pay for energy with no SWIFT links? Next one, we do not support Joe Biden's sanctions on Russia. Sanctions will only hurt ordinary Americans by further hiking up gas prices. Biden's already slashed domestic production and the Saudis have declined to raise output. Well, this new sanctions package will cripple America, not Russia. And finally, you're hurting Americans at the pump. Your sanctions are going to hurt us more than Russia. And the only ones in Russia that would be hurt are ordinary people there, just like the ones that you're hurting here at home. Open up the pipelines and drop all federal fuel taxes. Okay, some of the social media posts which seem to agree with us in terms of how ordinary people are suffering. Okay, joining us in this segment of the Q&A is Attilio Boron. He's a political scientist and international analyst who joins us from Buenos Aires. Attilio Boron, welcome. We're taking a look at, obviously, what has happened with this conflict, of Russia's military operation, which has shocked the oil markets. Looking for replacements has been something that the U.S. is after, but it hasn't been successful. In the meantime, obviously, Europe is wanting to go with the U.S., but finding a replacement for oil and gas is a tough thing. What is your assessment as to whether this can be done to help the ordinary people who are suffering the most here?
Not at all. The world is hungry and thirsty of consuming oil, so there will be no problem for the Russians. Of course, there will be necessary to make some adjustments in all the pipelines which Russia has developed, but there is no question that they could divert the proportion, a high proportion at least, of the oil that they were exporting to Russia to the south.
That's indeed going to be a challenge also. Our next guest, Carlos Martinez, joins us from London. He is an activist and political analyst. Carlos Martinez, welcome to the program. If we were to take a look at an ulterior motive that the U.S. may have on this, it has pointed to it's shale gas. And, of course, that involves fracking. But we know the hazards that are involved with that environmentally, at the same time, the inferior quality that consists of shale gas. How can that even be used to provide shortages, for example, in the case of Europe? Is that even feasible?
Yeah, it's a really important question that's been largely ignored, actually. You know, with the advent of fracking, hydraulic fracturing of shale rock, the US has gone from being an energy importer to being an energy exporter. Now, in terms of the current crisis in Europe, that has a couple of consequences. Firstly, the US isn't really worried so much about sanctioning Russian energy because it's not reliant on it. Secondly, the US gets a positive benefit because it means a bigger market for US energy. That's why the US has been for years trying to scupper the Nord Stream 2 project, because they don't want to see Europe dependent on Russian energy, and they do want to see Europe dependent on American energy. Obviously, for European consumers, this turn to shale is a disaster because fracking is much more expensive. And to be transported across the Atlantic, fracked gas has to be converted to liquid. It has to be stored at, you know, maybe minus 60 degrees centigrade, pumped thousands of kilometers. So that's an expensive process.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we searched and are now ready to present to you some economic news from around the world. Well, you guessed it. It's hard to look for economic news where the Russia-Ukraine conflict is not involved, like this particular piece of news that comes from the UK. UK farmers are warning that soaring gas costs could cut food production. Farmers there are looking at a drop of up to 50% in the amount that they can afford to grow because of the soaring energy costs that are happening in that country. Of course, that's something that the UK is going to be grappling for quite some time. Moving out to the next topic here, premature pullout is the title we've given it. That could be the case of foreign companies that pulled out of Russia. Russia announced it plans to seize assets of Western companies that have pulled out of the country. The Russian President Vladimir Putin preparing economic retaliation for Western sanctions. That includes laws to impound $10 billion of leased airline jets. Russia said it could take temporary control of the departing businesses where foreign ownership exceeds 25%. All right, up to the next crisis. West Asia and North African countries are facing a severe wheat crisis over the Ukraine crisis. West Asia and North African countries are relying, well, they rely heavily on wheat imports from Russia and also from Ukraine, with around 70% of its wheat coming from both of those countries. Some 80% of Tunisia's grain also hails from these two countries. Lebanon, 60% of its wheat comes from Ukraine, so you can see how that obviously spells disaster for those countries when it comes to wheat. Argentina has had a fallout with the IMF before over loans and defaulting on it, but both are eager to get back into it again. But why? In which you have a $45 billion IMF loan that IMF has agreed with that country. Again, there have been loan defaults from Argentina. There was a case back in 1994 where they were heavily involved in a feud when it came to the fact that Argentina felt its sovereignty was violated. The government was going to default on a $19 billion repayment. That's part of the reason why it actually went for that loan. Well, those were the stories that we thought would be okay for this program for us to cover.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to the U.S. sanctions on Russia, the U.S. went from being somewhat in doubt or hesitant about sanctioning Russia's oil and energy sector. And then from that, it went to a full-fledged trade embargo. Full-fledged, that meant no Russian imports and no trade with Russia. But at what cost? Did the U.S. really think about that? Well, we're going to be taking a look at some of those aspects. First, we're going to pose this question: how do U.S. sanctions on Russia affect the West? Well, the only way to look at it is through the numbers, and here you have one of them. Russia's oil and gas exports account for 25% of global exports. That's a quarter of global exports Russia accounts for. Next up, the impact on the U.S. It imported an average of over 20.4 million barrels of crude oil and refined petroleum products from Russia, and that was each month for the year 2021, which accounted for 8% of U.S. liquefied fuel imports. As a result, you're looking at an average gasoline price, $4.07 per gallon nationally. Insiders in the industry are concerned if it hits $200 per barrel, we may be looking at prices at the pump even going higher than that. And that's a possibility. Inflation is now a concern. The U.S. CPI surged to 7.5% in January, the fastest annual rise in 40 years, with sanctions on Russia putting more pressure, obviously, on inflation. Food, electricity, and shelter, the biggest drivers of inflation. Energy prices, as you can see, up 27%. And Goldman Sachs saying that if oil reaches $150 per barrel, we're looking at even more when it comes to energy costs. Now the EU. Russia is the largest single energy source in the EU. If Russian gas exports are banned, it's going to be tough to bring it from other places. A third of the EU's natural gas and a quarter plus of its crude oil comes from Russia also. There are different aspects to this. But who is going to bear the most brunt, the worst part of it? Germany, the largest economy in Europe. More than half of Germany's natural gas and over 30% of its crude oil supply comes from Russia. Germany has come out along with the EU making a statement that perhaps they're going to put the brakes on banning Russian oil, and they may go in phases. Who knows? They're still a little on one side or the other when it comes to the way that they're going to approach this. Okay, people are bearing the brunt of this. That is what we're focusing on. And here is a case in point, which we obviously are going to take a look at the average people in the U.S. and what they think about what is happening regarding the oil prices and, of course, the conflict in Ukraine.
Not good. The price of gas has gone up. And I got an 8-cylinder engine in here, and I use about $20 every 2 days to try to. I just try to get as much miles as I can out of what I'm doing. And, you know, but gas prices are going to go up.
And the increase of the gas is keep increasing. Every day it's keep going up, and the jobs are going decent, going down. Every day it's going down. So it's affecting my budget. It's affecting everybody.
I would rather have high gas prices here than an authoritarian regime in the Ukraine. So if we have to suffer with a little bit of inflation and gas prices for a while to assure that such a wonderful country as Ukraine has an opportunity to develop its democracy, we should do that.
Well, it might be easy for her to say that because I think I saw her pumping actually gasoline into her BMW. Anyways, let's get some analysis into this. We have Attila Boron, who's a political scientist and international analyst, who rejoins us. Attila Boron, Shell producers in the U.S., they stand to obviously benefit from what is going on here. When we take a look at what is happening with sanctions, however, that's what I'd like to focus with you. Do you think that these sanctions that they're placing against Russia is actually going to work in terms of the intended, I guess, purposes that the U.S. has, and in turn the EU, which appears to be following the lead of the U.S.?
Well, you know, I don't think that Mr. Biden has thought over all the implications of these policies of sanctions, because experience shows that sanctions do not work. How many years have been the United States sanctioning other countries? Take the case of Cuba, more than 60 years. Take the case of Iran, 20, 25 years at least. And I don't think this is going to really have a dramatic impact on Russia. Of course, it will create some difficulties to the Russian people, but I don't think that the American expectations, a sort of collapse of Russia because of the sanctions, is not going to happen.
Okay. Well, Carlos Martinez, activist and political analyst, rejoins us from London to understand from him what is happening here. Carlos Martinez, welcome back.
you're looking at a situation where European gas prices are trading for what we understand at $500 per barrel. Another stat that's very alarming, 40 million UK citizens heading for fuel poverty. Americans obviously are also kind of suffering, as we just played with gas prices. U.S. may reap the benefits because of its geopolitical intentions, but what about Europeans? First of all, will Russia have oil buyers? And how Europe is going to cope with all of this?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if Europe will cope. 40 million UK citizens in fuel poverty is nearly two-thirds of the population. And obviously, we're not talking about the wealthy. We're talking about ordinary working class and middle-income people who are paying the price of this war in a very real way. You know, ordinary people actually in Britain and Europe benefit not one bit from an escalating war in Ukraine, from NATO's expansion, from aggression against Russia. Actually, given a choice and presented with the facts of the situation, they would much rather have peace in Europe. And there's an opportunity for peace. You know, if NATO is willing to engage on Russia's security concerns, which are not in the least bit unreasonable, then the crisis could end tomorrow. Meanwhile, the imposition of unprecedented, unilateral, illegal sanctions isn't going to bring the war to an end. It's going to extend the war. Meanwhile, it's causing significant suffering for ordinary people in the very countries that are issuing the sanctions. Is it causing suffering in Russia as well? Absolutely. You know, there's no question that these sanctions are going to hit Russian people hard. For all this talk of targeting so-called oligarchs, it's perfectly obvious that if you impose this kind of economic blockade, it's going to impact living standards. However, you look at the list of countries that's sanctioning Russia, it's the usual suspects. It's the US, it's Britain, it's the EU. Meanwhile, China, India, Iran, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, these countries aren't joining in with the sanctions. So Russia does at least have the possibility of bypassing this crisis to some degree.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed an immediate ban on Russian oil and other energy imports. Sanctions on Russia's oil and gas industry had once been viewed as mostly off the table, as officials in the U.S. and Europe were worried about a global spike in prices. The United Kingdom said that it would phase out imports of Russian oil and oil products by the year 2022, while the European Union said it would slash Russian gas imports to Europe by 66% by the end of the year.
By the end of this year, we can replace 100 BCM of gas imports from Russia. That is two-thirds of what we import from them. This will end our over-dependency and give us much-needed room to maneuver. Two-thirds. It's hard. Bloody hard. But it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
The U.S. imported an average of 209,000 barrels per day of crude oil and 500,000 barrels per day of other petroleum products from Russia in 2021. The full embargo would be most effective if it included European allies. Yet, it is far from clear that all of Europe would take part in an embargo. While the U.S. could replace the fuel it receives from Russia, Europe cannot immediately replace its energy imports from that country. Any curbs on Russian oil exports could send already skyrocketing oil and gasoline prices even higher and further squeeze businesses, financial markets, and the global economy.
We'll probably see gasoline trade even higher. Today was the highest level for gasoline at the pump basically ever in the United States. So not a good situation, not a good inflationary situation, really not a good political situation for the Democratic Party who was in power. And it's going to put upward pressure on all those issues.
The surging oil prices and threats of further sanctions on Russia's oil industry has pushed up gasoline prices in the U.S., with prices hitting above $4 a gallon of regular gas. In some states, the prices have already reached beyond $5 per gallon. The end of the Omicron surge and the removal of many COVID restrictions is encouraging people to get out of the house for more shopping, entertainment, and travel as well. U.S. trips and passenger vehicles have increased 25% since the beginning of the year, and that has pushed up demand for more gasoline in the U.S.
One of the things that is not so evident in the Russia-Ukraine conflict is the energy interests when it comes to the US, and that is worth taking a look at. First, there is the issue of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The US has been very keen in pumping Ukraine with arms and military equipment. It has rallied other countries, especially NATO countries, to do the same. Yet, it has refused to participate in the conflict militarily, instead throwing Ukraine into the fire. But why would the US do that, knowing that there would be an energy crisis as a consequence that could grip the entire world, as it has already? For one thing, the US, unlike the Europeans, has plenty of oil reserves. Based on one stat from 2019, the US proved reserves as of December 31st, 2019, was 44.2 billion barrels. But the Europeans, in contrast, can't enjoy the same privilege. In contrast, in 2020, Russia had 107.8 billion barrels worth of oil reserves, but that can't be counted anymore. In comparison, Norway had 7.9 billion barrels, which is the largest in Europe. But here is where there might be an incentive for the US to eliminate Russia oil from the market: US shale gas. Just in October 2020, US oil producers were on pace for the most bankruptcies since a last oil downturn. A slew of restructurings took place that put oil and gas producers on track for their biggest year of bankruptcies. The amounts are staggering. 36 producers with $51 billion in debt filed for bankruptcy protection in the first 8 months of the year. Now, the US shale producers are merging and are on track to come back online with a breath of new life pumped into them. But not so fast. This shale oil and gas is not the greatest product. It's more inferior and harms the environment tremendously. Its quality is nowhere near Russian oil and gas, for example. Hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling poisons groundwater, pollutes surface water, impairs landscapes, and threatens wildlife. And that does it for this section. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until the next program.
When the U.S. president announced a ban on all imports of Russian oil and gas, he knew what it would do to Americans. He even said, "I'm going to do everything I can to minimize Putin's price hike here at home." But what does he mean by that? I mean, ordinary Americans are having a hard time dealing with this. But what about the poor or the ones who are struggling to put food on the table? Does he have a game plan for them? Probably not when it comes to them. Just like he does not have a real strategy behind how to actually replace Russia's oil. Only time will tell how he's going to go about that. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you. For me, Kaveh Taghavei, and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.